The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, joined by our own young gun, Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. Love the shirt, Andy. And I know you love Jody Strittmatter.
Stritt's one of my good friends.
His go-to guy. He's doing a lot of good for the sport.
He's got birthday number 40 coming up this week.
40, huh?
40.
Man. I bet there's not a lot of guys that could get out from underneath him if he got on top, even if they're in their 20s.
Tell you what, that's maybe what we need to do is get Stritt into a veterans tournament here coming up pretty soon. He'll be eligible for those. Start getting him primed for...
He's eligible now. I think 20, he can be 35.
Oh, yeah. Is it 35?
Yeah, all right.
I thought it was 45.
He's ready to go. Would you ever do it?
No.
You wouldn't do it?
Absolutely.
Just give it a shot?
Absolutely not, Kyle. I'm still working the soreness out of my legs from playing one slow pitch softball game last week.
Oh my goodness. We're going to talk a lot of topics today. We'll talk statistics, but you're going to want to stick around for who we have for guests. We have Justin Tritz, the mastermind behind trackwrestling.com. That's going to be a lot of interesting information on how he processes information. We'll have him on first, followed by Sally Roberts, a two-time world medalist and the founder of Wrestle Like a Girl. So we have two interviews today. But if we go back to what we've talked about at length for the last couple shows, and that statistics, and we have more, Andy.
We do have more. We had Rob Waltko throwing some requests at us.
How'd that come about? I mean, I'm
glad on Twitter. He sent me a message, said, would love to see Anthony Valencia's plus minus. Seems to be in a lot of lopsided matches, win or lose. And Rob's spot on with that assessment. And so we took a dive into Anthony Valencia. And then he also asked about Ethan Lezak. So tell us more, Kyle.
We got a couple here. This was really fun to look at this one because Anthony Valencia in particular was 27-10 on the season, and you did mention the lopsidedness, and that's true. So the overall number was 8.2, so that means based on what we call a major decision now, I think we're disputing the relevance of major decisions or anything, because our world, we want those to go away. We just want them to be points, but he has an 8.2. And you go across the board here, the first four matches of the season were falls, so he got 22s, but talked about lopsided. You have a negative 14. You have a negative 1 in there. You have a negative 3. And then you go down to a negative 7, negative 11, and then a negative 11 and a negative 2. So, yeah, there are some bonus point wins that he had to deal with, but still comes out with an 8.2 with a 27-10 record. And then you take Ethan Lezak with a 31-7 record, comparable to what the numbers were for Anthony Valencia's 8.6. He had a 31-7 record, but had a couple negative 15, so gave up a couple technical falls, but had some big wins on the plus side, a lot of 22s there, and known for the tech fall, had a 15, 16, 16, and 15 run. So there's a guy that got on top and could turn you a lot.
Yeah.
So made up for those losses by some big wins. And then we just decided to delve into Darian Cruz, who had a better record, had an overall 9.4, 28-2 record. I was a little surprised as you listed off the numbers that he was as dominant. I thought he had a few more close matches, but had a lot of big point wins over the season.
He did. And you look back on the schedule that he wrestled and didn't run into Tomasello, didn't run into Spencer Lee during the regular season, didn't hit a lot of those tough guys from the Big Ten. And so strength of schedule is a little bit different. That's where, Kyle, I think we need to figure out that part of the equation when we get to wrestling war.
Yeah.
Let's back it up, though. I mean, for the people that didn't listen to last week's show, they're filling some gaps here. We wanted to do point differential. So we assigned a fall as 22 points. You win by fall, you get plus 22. You lose by fall, minus 22. Lay that out, Kyle.
Well, the way we figured it out was that we just decided we like that point differential should dictate how a dual meet is scored. So instead of having a decision worth three, we just said if you win 2-1, you get 2 points for your team. The other guy gets 1 point. If you win 15-0, you get 15 for your team. The other guy gets 0 points. And so you just mathematically equate that into the team score. We decided that a fall should be worth 22 points because the maximum number you can get for a technical fall is to win by 21 points. So if you're up 14-0, you could go feet to back. That would be 6 points, so that would take you to 20, and then you have that riding time point that gets you 21. So the maximum amount of points you can get for a technical fall is 21. We say a fall is worth more than that, so we added another point, so it's worth 22. So that's how we got these numerical values of 22 for a fall, and then you just do the opposite. So you tabulate all that in, plus side for 22 if you get a fall, negative 22 if you get pinned, and then it just shakes out at the end, and that's how you get your number.
Awesome. We got some more. We got some more numbers we need to dive into. We got to figure out what all this means. Maybe we break it down just by NCAA championships at some point. Maybe we break it down by weight classes at some point and just see what the data tells us here.
You're right, though, because as you look at the numerical values, you see a lot of big numbers at the beginning of the season across the board.
I think
we've just done our small sample here. It's just like big numbers. You get 22s all across the board. And that just says that it's probably some junior college guys, Division III guys at some of the open tournaments, not taking anything away from that. But
hey,
maybe,
I was a junior college guy.
I know, hey, and neither of us could do well in any of these situations. So maybe it does need to be against Division I. Maybe that's the true essence of what we're trying to get to. It's Division I competition, just so it has some semblance of fairness across the board. But either way, it's a compelling number, and it's just a way to show your dominance and how you perform throughout the course of the season, win or lose.
I think what's really impressive is Zane Rutherford putting up that 17 number against Big Ten competition.
It's ridiculous, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that's more than what a technical fall is worth. Yeah, I mean, 15 is what you get to a technical fall, and he's banging out a 17 average. That's just insane. A perfect season would be a 22, so he's pushing the envelope on that. Just some massive scores, and that's just a complete domination. And it would be fun with Kale Sanderson being 159-0 to see what his total would be, just to figure out all those scores and see where he shakes out.
It's funny you mentioned that, because in my head I'm thinking back to some of the all-time greats in the greatest seasons that we've seen. I think back to maybe some of the numbers that Askren might have put up.
Yeah.
Royce Alger had, his senior season where he was racking up the pins before he moved up. I want to say it was his senior season, but there would be fun. It'd be fun to go back and look at some of those.
Yeah, or a Gable who pinned 31 out of 33 his junior year, had just a monster season. Dan Hodge, 36 pins out of 46 matches through his career. It's not as big of a compilation of data, but certainly has some big wins there, so it'd be fun to check those out. And it's different a little bit too, because you didn't have a technical fall back in Gable's era, so he could rack up a 50-0 win, and it would how we would do those equations would be a little bit different, but those would be some monster seasons. We did do Kyle Snyder. He was 17-1 on the year, and he came out with an 11.5. So he had some of those early season pins, had 4 pins to start off the season. But I think across the board, you're probably going to see heavyweights be a little bit lower number than most other wrestlers.
Well, that would be fun to go back and look at heavyweight now versus 10, 12 years ago.
I agree with that. John Lockhart comes to mind.
Yeah.
I mean, he had every match was, 1 or 2 points or tiebreaker?
Didn't he go through, I think, Iowa City 2001. He went through the NCAA championships and I think won the coin flip on all of them, didn't he?
I think you're right on that.
Let's look this up.
That was a crazy season where he won everything either by a point or in tiebreakers or overtime. It was just this insane tournament. I think 2001, he ended up beating Tommy Rollins in the finals of the NCAA championships.
John Lockhart. You should go to Vegas with John Lockhart. Here's what his NCAA championship run looked like in 2001. 5-4 tiebreak winner over James Hummel of Oklahoma State, 4-2 OT winner over Jake Verselli of Purdue, 3-2 winner over Matt Brink of Michigan in the quarters, 2-1 tiebreaker winner over Garrett Lowney in the semis, and 2-1 tiebreaker winner over Tommy Rollins in the final. So he didn't win them all on tiebreaks, but three of the five, another one in overtime, and then a 3-2 blowout for him.
So only one quarters. Was regulation.
Yeah, only one was regulation.
One was regulation. What an incredible run to win it. And you're going against a guy that's tough and Tommy Rollins in the finals. Rollins was a freshman that year. And then the next year he ends up beating Steve Mako in the finals in the same situation. I think Tommy Rollins got won the coin flip and ended up winning in 2002.
So John Lockhart's average.
Yeah, pull this up.
Is 1.2
for the NCAA tournament.
NCAA championship run, 1.2 average.
Yeah, so that just goes to show that you could have a couple losses with our formula and come up with still a monster number. And I think that's why it's so effective, is because you just see the domination side of it. You get to say that just because you won an NCAA championship, it's a true numerical value of how dominant you were throughout the season. And I think that's what we all want. We want to see those numbers. And let's, even though that you had a couple guys in Valencia and Lezak that had some losses, they still had a monster numbers on our scale. They were over 8.
Yeah. So while you're talking, Kyle, I pulled up Cale's bracket that year.
Okay. And for 01.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Cale averaged a 14 at the NCAA championships. During his run, he had a first round Tech fall, so he's plus 15 there. Won in the second round by fall, 15-point win in the quarters, 14-point win in the semis. How about that? 21-7 in the semis, and then 8-4 over Daniel Cormier in the finals.
The hardest part, though, is we'd have to change the numerical value for a fall because they did not have 4 near falls in that era. So we would have to change it.
Now you're getting way too complex.
I know, but you have to, though.
All right.
That's why we went through all of this. I know that it's still the same numerical value. It's still a 14. It doesn't change that. But if he had a fall, it does make a difference. I know we're getting a little complex here, but that's what we do. We try to figure this out.
So he's 13.8 instead of 14.
That's still strong work, Cale. You still get the OW for that tournament. We have a special guest to kick off the show. It's Justin Tritz, mastermind of track wrestling, or officially the general manager of and founder of track wrestling, and most important, a Fargo All-American. How are you, Justin?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Kyle?
Hey, we're doing great. We're excited to learn more about track wrestling because it's been a great product for fans, parents, everyone that wants to get involved in the sport. I think just going back, have you always been a wrestling savant? Has wrestling always been something that you wanted to see grow and develop?
Yeah, I mean, wrestling has been a part of my life since I can remember. I wouldn't say a savant, but definitely a participant. And, you know, I've been involved at the wrestling level, coaching level, parent level, pretty much coaching anything from youth up to high school. So definitely been involved in it for a long time.
How'd you get involved?
It would be my dad, like most young boys, I guess. So I don't even remember bringing home a slip or anything. I'm sure my dad just brought me to practice, and we didn't even have wrestling shoes, so he didn't have to give me a pair of shoes. You know, wrestling high tops, and I don't really remember anything but wrestling. You know, I obviously played Little League baseball and stuff, but there was never it was just part of life.
Andy and I have talked on numerous occasions, even on this show and this podcast, about the evolution of wrestling and how it has made just monumental changes within the last 20 years. You've been a part of that. What made you think about this? How did you want to make wrestling better and know that there's a better way to do things? What was it that triggered for you that said, hey, we can do better than what we have right now?
I mean, it was actually a really simple idea. The idea of track wrestling altogether wasn't something that I thought of initially. It was a simple sitting. I was in a computer science classes at the university, and I was at the state tournament, and we don't seed our state tournament in Wisconsin. And there was matchups happening in the quarterfinal round that everybody in the stadium knew was should be a finals match. And the big argument for not seeding the state tournament was always it would be biased by the committee or the people that were doing it. There's no way they could know everybody, et cetera. Same stuff you hear all over the place. So I thought, you know, if you could come up with just a set of rules, enter them into a computer, and when the state tournament came around, apply the rules and see who comes out where would be better than a blind draw. So wrote a program to do that, ran it on some of the state tournaments or on the state tournament data that I was watching, and it seemed like it did better. I mean, the two kids that were meeting in the quarterfinals weren't going to meet, so that's a good first criteria. And then pitched it to actually the bi-state tournament in La Crosse to see if they'd be interested in using it during the regular season. And they basically said yes, but we would need it to do all this other stuff in order for it to be really useful. So I programmed those other things and brought it to another tournament and said, hey, now it does this. Would you guys be interested? And basically took off from there. So the whole thing pretty much just snowballed over the course of however many years it's been, with bringing it to people, them using it, giving me ideas, programming them in, and, you know, everything went from there.
Justin, where'd you see your life heading prior to that?
I was going to be a professor. So I really wanted to be a computer science professor. Actually, starting out in undergrad, I was going to be a math professor. Had to take a minor. So decided to minor in computer science. But then I got one class into computer science and just absolutely loved it. So switched my mind or changed my mind to want to be a computer science professor and majored in that. And obviously in order to be a professor, you need to go to grad school. So ended up going to graduate school in Madison. I was actually had started track wrestling while I was an undergrad at La Crosse. So it was sort of going in the background. And started going through graduate school in Madison. It just got to be way too much to try and run a business while going through graduate school, because graduate school is obviously demanding and you got to put everything into it to be successful. And decided I would just focus on track wrestling.
How does your mind work? How do you process information?
Oh, I think anybody that's good at computer science probably is very black and white as far as how your mind works. I find my brain actually works a lot like a computer, I think. So there's lots of times that I'll be doing something and my wife will come in and tell me a bunch of stuff and ask me some questions. And 5 minutes later, I'll answer. And, you know, just like a computer queues up tasks and does what they're doing and then gets other stuff and other information and works through it. I think I actually... my brain works a little bit like that. So, gets me into trouble in life sometimes, but
is
part of me.
Is that what you want to accomplish with track? Is to take the emotion out of it, just to try to make this pretty matter of fact and how you execute results?
For sure. I mean, any computer program, you want to just be very black and white. This is how it is. Whatever rules you write into it, it does what you tell it. Doesn't always work out like that. Sometimes computers and technology don't do exactly what you want them to do or what you thought you told them to do. But definitely when you write something, you want it to do exactly what you tell it.
So we talk a lot in terms of how do you grow the sport and how do you process information as far as, hey, there can be better rule changes and referees and the human side. When you look at that, what do you want to accomplish out of the sport? What do you want to see wrestling get to?
Well, I think anybody wants the United States to win world and Olympic titles, to be dominant like Russia, you know, has been for so many years. And in order to do that, you have to get more people involved in the sport. You have to get people excited about the sport. You have to publicize the sport, all of the things that it takes in order to essentially recruit and get people wanting to do it. So, you know, to date, I think we've been really successful at that. Something as simple as, you know, wrestler profiles. kids being able to, kids and parents and coaches being able to sort of see what they're accomplishing throughout their career. And it's actually amazing how important those profiles are to people.
You said that track wrestling snowballed, and you're at this point. So over the course of over a decade of having track wrestling, I'd like to know what that snowball looked like. How did you gain momentum? How did you get people on board? What was the plan to get you to this point? Because it just doesn't happen. Was there a couple key moments that got you to the point where people believed in this product?
Absolutely. The first year, I think we did 35 tournaments, and everything for a long time, track wrestling was growing simply by word of mouth. So it was, people that attended tournaments that were run on track wrestling so within Wisconsin is where it really started to grow. And the first couple of years, maybe I think it was like the second or third year, the WIAA, which is the high school governing body in Wisconsin, agreed to run their state tournament series on it. And, as soon as you expose track wrestling to everyone in Wisconsin, then there was just huge growth within Wisconsin. And then the neighboring states, you always get the Minnesotas and the Illinois and the Iowas that come to Wisconsin tournaments and bring it back with them. So that was big. And then USA Wrestling was a huge piece to it because we were the first tournament software to be able to manage vertically paired tournaments. And I actually think we're still the only software that can bracket vertically paired tournaments. And for a long time, USA Wrestling was vertical pairing. So they used it out in Fargo, which Fargo has a huge draw. Lots of people get exposed to the software there, pairs from USA Wrestling, things like that. So that generated a lot of growth. And then the biggest thing that we did was when we partnered with the NWCA, and the NWCA picked it up as their official bracketing software, and we helped with the OPC and statistics and things like that, because then we exposed it to high school coaches and college coaches across the country, and it just really took off.
Who have you brought into the fold with track wrestling that can balance out maybe some of your, not necessarily weaknesses, but areas you're not as strong? Who have you brought on the team to make sure that you cover those gaps?
Well, I think our whole team covers some of those gaps. We're on the phone with one of them right now, and Andy. Andy is a fairly recent hire, I guess, but, relative to others, I guess. But, there's just lots of people that bring different pieces to track wrestling in order to make it operate very professionally and make up for many of my shortcomings.
What ultimately do you want track wrestling to accomplish? You're in a great spot right now, but as you look to the next 10 years, what can track wrestling do that's even bigger and better than where it is right now?
Well, it might sound weird to say this because I think we're close to already being this, but we have a long ways to go while we're close. And that is being the central repository for all results and video and everything that's going on in the wrestling world. Because when it's all said and done, there has to be some sort of a historical record of what's happened. Right now, if I wanted to go look up what happened in Fargo in 1996, I don't even know where I'd go. I'd probably try to go to themat.com and see if they have anything posted, but I don't know that they do. I can't go look at John Smith's profile and see, what tournaments he wrestled in as a kid. And those kinds of things are so valuable. Even they might not seem so valuable when John Smith is a second grader wrestling in the Pittsville Open, but 20, 30 years down the road, even 5 years down the road, all of a sudden that stuff becomes really valuable. So I would love to see wrestling get to that point where we have that historical record in one place. I think we're the perfect place to do that.
Do you get feedback from fans and parents on what they want to see from your site?
Absolutely. We get feedback on a regular basis. We can't keep up with all of the things that people request, but it's very, very nice to see all of the things come through and be able to evaluate and say, okay, this one's come through, 5 times, 10 times, 100 times. So move this up in the priority queue. With any business, there's going to be lots of things that you want to accomplish and lots of things that you want to do. It comes down to how many of them you can actually get done in, as fast as he can.
What's the most common? What are you getting hit with the most often?
Oh man, I'd have to go to my to-do list. But so for right now, we're going to release this. No one's actually heard about this yet, but might as well release it here. So we're going to release what we're calling right now. We're calling it a team tracker, but basically, the idea of being able to log into a tournament and pick some wrestlers that you really care about, and having all of the information in that event at your fingertips, and not having to necessarily browse to different pages to go find it, or making that interface as easy as possible for me to go to a tournament and follow my two kids, or me to go to a tournament as a coach and follow the 10 wrestlers that I'm there to coach, or the 30 wrestlers that I'm there to coach. So, you know, that's an example of something that's at the top of the list right now, and, you know, we'll have ready before the start of next season.
Does it blow you away that we have this opportunity with track wrestling and just on an online medium that we get a chance to have all the NCAA championship matches? We've talked about this before, but you're on the development end of this, where we get to watch all the NCAA championship matches, where you were lucky to get a highlight package of the finals at midnight. You've seen this happen. What's been your take on why we've gotten to this point where it's been just monumental amount of access for the sport of wrestling?
So I would say that is directly related to Anthony Holman. I mean, I worked with Jeff Jarnicki for a couple of years, and I absolutely would say nothing bad about Jeff. But I've worked with Anthony for a lot longer, so I know Anthony a lot better. And he's just a huge advocate for wrestling. When, you know, he listens to ideas, and, you know, when we said, hey, it would be really nice to be able to put something together to allow people to watch all the matches from the NCAA championships, I mean, he was an advocate for us. He wanted to make that happen. Granted, there's, you know, hoops to jump through and all those kinds of things in order to make stuff like that happen. But he's just been fantastic from an NCAA perspective, pushing things forward.
As far as the feedback you get with parents most often, I mean, you talked about the kids and having a second grader on there. From what I've seen, a lot of these parents, they just love to be able to go on track and see what their kids did. The kids love to see what they did. Did you realize that that they're gravitating toward it that way, where they really get to track across the nation against their competition? Do you realize what it's really doing for the sport, and that they really get into their records and how important it is to these kids?
Absolutely. I mean, you see it, and kids take pride in it, and parents take pride in it. I mean, sometimes, you know, tickets come in or something, and people are like, oh, my kid's profile, my kid's profile, my kid's profile. And it seems like a small thing, right? It's like, oh, somebody listed him as getting pinned, and he lost 4-2. And to most people, that's like, I mean, pretty much to anybody, that's like, why would you care about that? But at the same time that you say, why would you care about that? It's so nice to know that people care that much about those profiles. You want to have accurate historical records. You want to have people passionate about the sport. You want kids to be proud of their profile, proud of their accomplishments, and all those things. So, I mean, yeah, that stuff comes through, and we definitely see how much people take pride in those profiles and how much it's being used for, you know, doing other people's accomplishments. You know, if you go, I know there's tons and tons of people out there that when they go to a tournament and look at the bracket, one of the first things they do is Johnny's wrestling Steve, click on Steve's profile and see what he's done.
Yeah.
So it's huge.
Andy has a yellow notepad here. It's empty right now, but are we getting to the point where paper is going to be obsolete in our world?
I don't know. I mean, I think at some point we will. Paper is, we have a paper mill in our town, and actually it was booming 30 years ago. And now it's probably cut our population down in half because of all of the jobs that were lost in paper, but they're still printing paper for, you know, water bottles and whatever else you need to put labels on. So is paper going away from a, like record keeping? Probably. At some point, I'm sure it will, but paper will still be around, or at least I hope it is.
Hey, you're in a business where you're promoting and you're marketing wrestling all the time. You live this. Do you get a chance to enjoy the sport, or has it become just part of your DNA and it's just how you roll?
No, I mean, I've always enjoyed the sport. And for a while there, it was really, you know, I coached and I loved coaching, and eventually had to give up coaching because work was around track wrestling was too busy. My kids are now involved in wrestling. I coach the youth club. There's a lot of things in place at track wrestling that allow me to have more freedom to enjoy, you know, going and coaching or going and watching an event. I guess one really good example of that is the World Cup. So World Cup was in Iowa City. It was being streamed on track wrestling. And I got to take, you know, me and some friends and their kids and a group of people down and sit in the stands and watch the World Cup and, you know, get down on the floor and let the kids meet some of the athletes. I mean, it was an incredible experience that I would have never had if it weren't for essentially being a general manager of track wrestling and having built it. So,
what does Travis Shives bring to the organization?
Professionalism. So, he's just, if you've ever interacted with him, everything is extremely professional. You know, get him and Andy in a room, Andy can appreciate this, and they're going to absolutely make sure that everything that's going on about the business is done in a professional manner. The way that you interact with anybody, the way that we handle ourselves, conduct ourselves in public. So, I mean, and on top of that, he also does a lot of organization with, you know, with clients. He works for USA Wrestling. He's been around the wrestling space for a long time. So, knows a lot of people, knows what's going on, and can interact with UWW, for example, stuff like that in a professional way.
Jim Makovsky, the head wrestling coach at Minnesota State Mankato, said he's the second biggest ladies man behind him. Would you agree with that? Is Travis Shives a ladies man?
I have no idea.
You don't?
I don't even think I've met his wife before. So,
oh, okay.
I can't speak to any of that.
Yeah,
I'll have to just take Jim's word for it.
I know, and Jim likes to pimp people and kind of do that. So it actually surprised me that he didn't put him as number one, that Jim said he was number one. But it really falls in line with how Jim rolls.
Huh. Good stuff.
All right. Hey, we appreciate you being on the program. This is fun catching up about track wrestling and what you're doing. Can't wait to see what's going to happen here in the future with track wrestling. But it sounds like you're pretty close to being where you want to be. But love that you're advancing the sport, and appreciate all you're doing to advance wrestling.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on, Kyle.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right. See you, Andy.
We enjoyed that insightful interview with Justin Tritz of TrackWrestling.com. Really learned a lot about the evolution of how they got to this point. I think it's a lot of fun to see the progress from, what, 2004, Andy, until 2018. We have 14 years of data. Kind of just started in that kind of Macintosh type of feel where he just had an idea, and here we are 14 years later, and we get to benefit and reap the benefits of his progress in his mind.
Yeah, I love stories like this about people that like you say, just having an idea and go for it. We look at, we had Jesse Lang on the show here a couple weeks ago, and that was a really fascinating interview for me with the origins of Rudis and the early years there, and basically just having a dream and following it and making it happen.
And I think the storyline here to me that's really cool is that these people that are really changing the sport aren't necessarily our greatest champions. Jesse Lang was never an All-American. He talked about that. He was disappointed by his performance in college, felt like he could have done so much more, but transitioned that into just a great idea, a great concept in Rudis. Justin Tritz the same way. And as we have our upcoming guest in Sally Roberts, two-time world bronze medalist. She reached a very high level, but maybe not our biggest name in women's wrestling by any means, but has gone even higher with what she's done with the Wrestle Like a Girl platform and making an even bigger difference through her unique outlet to promote women's wrestling.
Yeah, and I think you could name off a lot of people that fall under this into this category, right? I mean, you look at Andy Barth, Mike Novogratz, people that have made an incredible impact on the sport of wrestling with their generosity and what they've enabled the United States to do on the international circuit with keeping top level athletes in the game. the generosity that they've had for the sport. It's the Living the Dream Metal Fund, Titan Mercury Wrestling Club. Their contributions have been felt significantly here in the last decade or so.
And that's what I like, is we're referencing Sally Roberts. She may be the biggest name in women's wrestling right now, just from a vantage point of what she's accomplished and the awareness that she's brought, just being on national news, national television stations, the connection she has. It's really been fun to see how she's developed into that environment where we really have taken women's wrestling to another level and we're embracing it. I think that a lot of people that were detractors 10 years ago are now on board, and I don't really hear the same comments I heard about women's wrestling 10, 15 years ago as we do today. And it's because of work like Sally Roberts has performed and has done and just been on that cutting edge. And I think that a lot of that is credits due to her. Terry Steiner has been an advocate. What a great person. And he's even said that. He thought it was weird. And he thought, I grew up in an environment where you just didn't do that. And so it took him a long time to come around on it. So two people that have really advanced the sport. And just like you say, they aren't the Dan Gables of the world. They're just people in the trenches that have taken us to a new level.
I love the Terry Steiner story and how he wound up with the job that he's in now as the women's freestyle national coach, and how he basically kept looking for somebody to tell him to side with him and saying, no, don't take this job. But everywhere he went, like at first, he tells the story about how Rich Bender approached him. If memory serves me correct, Terry was looking at some college jobs, trying to get back into the college game, and Rich asked him about the women's freestyle job, and Terry, didn't want anything to do with it, and he listened to Rich, and Rich pitched him on the job, and everywhere Terry went, looking for somebody to tell him no, get back into college wrestling, he was hearing from people saying, you got to give this a shot. And here's why. And ultimately, if memory serves me correct, the thing that drove the point home for him was his wife saying, "You got a little girl at home. What would you say to her?" And so that to me was that's one of my favorite stories. And seeing in the position that he's in now, and then you look at just the explosive growth that we've seen in women's wrestling in the last couple of years in particular. It's phenomenal. And one of the things that's really wild to me, and you look back on Paris too, who could have imagined a decade ago that John Smith and Kerry Collat
not me
would be in not the corner as assistant coaches on that team.
You're right. What a great point. Yeah. I would have never thought that John Smith, our icon in the sport, 6 world and Olympic championships, would be the women's coach. It just never occurred to me that that could happen. And I don't know what your personal view was 20 years ago, but I think a lot of people were just rolling their eyes like, what are they doing? Why are they doing this? But it's hard to go back to that because I think we're both so on board with women's wrestling that I can't see any other way. It just is. It just makes so much sense. And Terry Steiner's famous quote, if it's such a great sport, if it develops us in such a great way, why would we want to limit it to half the population? I think most of us are beyond that right now. I think most of us are of the frame of mind that this is something that is really good for women, and we want them to participate as much or more than they have before. So it's really been a great positive growth.
Yeah, and not just the growth in terms of numbers, but growth in terms of the quality of the product too. Mm-hmm. It's come so far in the last even 5 years. I think back to 5-6 years. I think back to the 2012 Olympic trials, and then if you were to pull out video clips of the 2012 trials versus what we're seeing on the mat now, it's, to me, it's night and day in terms of the high level of skill that we're seeing, the skill level that we're seeing out there on the mat.
Our guest today, Sally Roberts, 2-time world medalist, and more importantly, she is the founder of Wrestle Like a Girl, which is advancing women's wrestling across the country. Sally, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Great to have you on the program. I did not mention your military background, which I think is fascinating. Can you fill us in on how you got started in the military and why that was an important direction for your life?
Sure. In 2008, I took second at Olympic trials, and because of placing second, instead of being elated, I went into a bit of a depression and sat on the end of my bed for far too long, licking my wounds. And I knew that unless I changed my physical space, my mental space would never change. So I went and joined the Army. I actually went to a recruiter and said, I want the toughest job that a woman can have right off the street. And he said, you're in luck. We have a job for you. So I enlisted into psychological operations, which is under the umbrella of special operations, and joined the Army.
Whenever there's a female wrestler on, because it's fairly new and it's still getting into the national consciousness about female wrestling, it's always important to just go back and realize how you got started in the sport. How did you get started in wrestling?
I got started when I was in eighth grade. I was getting into a lot of trouble. I would go out after school and I would shoplift, break into houses, get into fights. I ended up getting arrested so many times that the juvenile detention officer and the police officers that I was encountering said, unless you find something to do after school, you're going to be going to juvie. And growing up in Seattle, I couldn't have told you what Harvard, Stanford, or even the University of Washington was, but I knew what juvie was and I knew I didn't want to go. So I had looked at the after-school activities. I tried out for softball, basketball, volleyball. I got cut from all three sports. I was being told I was unathletic, when in fact, I really didn't know how to play well with others at all. And when I looked down the list, I saw that wrestling was a no-cut sport. I knew that if I went out for wrestling and I never quit, I wouldn't go to jail. And that was how I began my wrestling career.
Why did you get into some of those kind of habitual activities that might have gone to a downward spiral? Did you have friends that influenced you? Was it just part of your culture?
Probably more to do with the culture that I had growing up. My mom had been married five times, and I didn't like being at home. And when you're a young kid and you're growing up, like, we were in a lower socioeconomic class on the wrong side of the tracks, and that's a bit of the culture where you grow up. So I was really just looking at my peers and seeing the behaviors that they were doing, and I was exhibiting them. And so one of the things that I've come to learn about myself, and I'm 38 now, and I learned this at a very early age, was that I was the sum of who I hung out with, and I had to start changing those people, because the people that I were hanging out with, they weren't the right kids, and I was getting into trouble. And when I transitioned over and I went into wrestling and I started wrestling and being able to advocate for myself and stick up for myself, wrestle. And I was also hanging out with a peer group now that really wanted to be successful, and they wanted to get A's and they wanted to go to college. Well, it sort of transformed who I was, and it also transformed the core group of humans that I was hanging out with at that point.
Sally, what do you recall about your state of mind and the change during that period of time, maybe during the first couple of years you were in wrestling?
You know, I remember the interesting things that probably are insignificant to most people. But for instance, when I first started going to practice, you know, growing up, I had a lot of acne on my face, and I would just slather it with this foundation that had Noxzema in it, because I thought that it was going to be the cure-all for my acne. And the first day in wrestling practice, I was wrestling with this guy, and my makeup came off on his white shirt, and he came over to me really disgusted and said, oh, what is this? And I remember being so embarrassed that I went to the bathroom and washed all my makeup off. And that was and I was so nervous to go from the gym back into the wrestling room, because I was going to have to be really vulnerable and authentic. And I walked in, I wasn't wearing any makeup, and no one cared. And that's when I thought, oh my gosh, I'm the only one that's in my own head with these perceptions over how people are thinking of me. And it's really symbolic of how I took on my wrestling career, which is I was able to really sort of come into my own, be authentic, and carry myself in a way that I had never been comfortable carrying myself before.
Take that concept where you did get into some trouble and then you got into a positive outlet. Does that change how you view people? Because it seems like we have a tendency to label people pretty early. How did you take that experience and just change how you viewed people?
It has really opened my eyes to the different levels of educational statuses, socioeconomic. I mean, just by virtue of where you're born is going to determine whether or not you're going to be supported in sport and academia or not. And it's helped me understand why everyone needs wrestling, why wrestling is really one of the most beautiful sports. It's cost effective. There's a low barrier to entry. And what it does to especially youth who are seeking some sort of belonging, it affords them an opportunity to be a part of a group, to be a part of a culture that encourages leadership, that says, this is where we're at. And like, you and you alone, you're standing here on this mat. And if you get taken down, you have to get back up. And as much as when you get taken down, you want other people to help you, you can't. You have to learn how to help yourself. And then that way, wrestling, by virtue of skill, tenacity, grit, it helps build leaders. And everyone should be afforded the opportunity to see how tough and how valuable they are. And really, in my mind, when I look at across the landscape, to me, we are always hearing these words about safe spaces and we laugh about them. But in my mind, I think that for me, wrestling, the wrestling room was a safe space. I had to learn how to get back up. It was a place for me to have those courageous conversations followed by brave action saying, who am I? What am I made of? What am I born to do? How am I going to get there? And all I could do is look in the mirror and all you see is yourself. And so to me, it spoke volumes about why people need to be afforded opportunities so that they can try and become whoever they want to become.
What challenges do women face that men might not understand?
It depends on where you live in the United States. In California, some of the challenges that a girl might face is that she doesn't know which tournament to go to because there's so many. A challenge she might face is she's being recruited by so many colleges because she has so much competition and her wrestling has really developed. But if you're from Mississippi, male or female, the challenge that you're going to face is there's no sanctioned sport. There's no opportunity to wrestle unless you're in a club. And even those clubs are few and far between. Beyond that, you know, society, if you're a girl wrestling girl, like that is acceptable across the board as an overarching theme. But if there's not enough girls for you to compete with and you wrestle against a boy, that now challenges how we view women, how we view girls, how we view femininity. And it really draws out the debate of should girls even be wrestling? Where if you're a girl wrestling a girl, it's completely fine. But on the other hand, and this is the counter argument is, well, if you're a boy wrestling a boy, that's fine. But if you're a boy wrestling a girl, well, even if you win, you're not that great. And if you lose, you're going to be shamed for life. But even the way we have those conversations for that co-ed sport, when it is co-ed, because we just don't have enough numbers, it becomes a challenge and it becomes really hard to navigate.
Is it awkward for you to wrestle a male, or was that awkward the first time you had to encounter wrestling another male?
You know, for me, it was never awkward. I had two older brothers and we would fight, we would wrestle, we would roughhouse. That was the language and that was the culture in our house. When I look at other people like a Helen Maroulis who grew up in a different culture and had a different language and she was very shy and reserved, I imagine that for her, it was probably more of a challenge. So for me, it was not a problem. And I'll tell you that going all the way through junior high and high school, I wrestled boys. When I was in college, I wrestled girls. But then when I joined the Army's world-class athlete program and I wrestled for the Army, I was back to co-ed. I wrestled with Spencer Mango and Harry Lester and John Anderson on a regular basis. And we would also wrestle with the girls. There was no differentiation between a male and a female wrestler. Once you walked into the Army's wrestling room, everyone was a wrestler.
Taking that concept of female wrestling and just getting it more into the mainstream, if you look at wrestling as a spectrum, where is women's wrestling on the spectrum? If the end game is full acceptance, full understanding about women being involved in wrestling, where do you think we are on that scale?
We are more than halfway there. Before, when I used to have conversations about women's wrestling, it was often met with some sort of challenge or consternation. And now when I have conversations about it, it's no longer met with those same barriers. The barriers are still there, but they're not as high and they're certainly not as inhibiting. So I would say we have more supporters than we do detractors, and we're more than halfway over the median. And as wrestling continues to grow and people are recognizing that when we have women's wrestling as a complement to men's wrestling, it makes our sport stronger. And even if you look at the collegiate landscape with colleges, there's colleges now like Presbyterian that's adding a Division I men's program and a women's program. And they're running it like a track and field program where you have one manager of wrestling, and then you have a head coach for women and a head coach for men. And the team is going to be built off of that camaraderie. And I think that's a really interesting place that we're going to, which is it's not men's wrestling versus women's wrestling, but now wrestling versus other sports and wrestling versus the world. And wrestling is becoming united. And the more that we can, the sooner we get there, the stronger our sport is going to be.
Let's go back 15 years to the 2003 World Championships, which were held in New York City. You had a world bronze medal, 7 women's weight classes, 7 women's medals at the World Championships. When you look back on that, I think you guys got second place to Japan, and it maybe it was a tie, and there must have been a tiebreaker.
That's right.
Yeah. If that happened today, it would be huge news. What did it feel like at the time when you guys got second, had a tremendous performance? Did it feel like there was some love, or was it just lost in the shuffle?
There's two different answers to your questions. One is that there is no better experience than being an American athlete wrestling on home soil. And for that year, it was in Madison Square Garden. And you could absolutely feel the love when it was an American wrestling. Anyone else, you could hear the vibration from all of the fans in Madison Square Garden cheering. And you knew that you were supported. And on the flip side, coming up second and tying with Japan, but losing in a tiebreaker because they had more gold medals than we did, it was incredibly heartbreaking to be so close to the top and to becoming a world championship team and falling just a little bit short. It was very, very hard. But what it did, it was able to highlight and showcase women's wrestling in a very spectacular and brilliant way in our home country. So maybe we didn't get as much support in some ways, but in other ways, we've got incredible support. And that's how we were able to get some of our champions on board. And remember, in 2003, we had the World Championships in Madison Square Garden, but we had been competing before that. So there was already people, there were already stakeholders and thought leaders that were championing the cause, that recognized the benefit of girls and women's wrestling. But now it brought it to the forefront of the American populace, of the wrestling community, to say, wow, these girls are good. And you know, that was also the first year that we had women's wrestling. They got announced to be in the Olympics. So there was a like about that same time frame, we all got to be residents. So that whole crew became residents at the Olympic Training Center, and we trained there. We grew up together, and we learned really well what it meant to fight, but also to protect our sport.
Why is Japan so dominant in women's wrestling?
Well, listen, we all have our own thoughts, but actually here is at least my perspective on it.
Okay.
In Japan, women's wrestling is one of the number one sports. But before they even start wrestling, they're doing judo, aikido, karate, taekwondo, and you name it. So they're already immersed in the combat culture, and wrestling to them is just an extension of that combat culture. Well, some of the most phenomenal athletes that we've had, like Christy Davis, she started out doing judo and she had a mean foot sweep. So one of the reasons that Japan's so phenomenal, in my opinion, is because they are multi-sport athletes that train in various versions of wrestling. Then when they go over to wrestling, it's an easy transition. But then on top of that, they have quality coaches and they have a really good funding mechanism that's really going to help those athletes get from wherever they're at to the top of the podium. But here's the other thing, and you probably read about this. Japan, for how great they perform, they don't treat their athletes that wonderful all the time. In fact, Kaori Icho had to actually complain because she was getting harassed by the president of their national federation, and he ended up resigning. And if there is a 4-time Olympic gold medalist that's complaining about harassment, you can only fathom what it's like to the athletes that hadn't had those accolades. So by no means is that country the most superior with everything they do.
Just take what you said there about just them being in the culture of growing up with combat sports. Have you ever just imagined what it would be like if we had some of our non-wrestling athletes? And I just think of a Serena Williams. What if she got into wrestling, how good she would be? Have you ever thought about what it would be like if there were other athletes that got into wrestling early?
I think it would be a game changer. It would be a game changer. And you actually can look across different sports that our youth are participating in. And when they get to college, college coaches are now, instead of recruiting these one sport athletes that are absolutely phenomenal, they're starting to say, well, let's look at the multi-sport athletes. Let's look at the athlete that has lettered in four varsity sports and gone to state in all of them because they're so well-rounded. I mean, there is absolutely a conversation that's happening. I'm on the United States Olympic Committee Youth Sport Working Group. And a lot of these elite coaches are saying, how can we really encourage our athletes in the United States to become multi-sport athletes? Gymnastics is a phenomenal base for wrestling. Any of the combat sports, judo, wrestling, karate, taekwondo, boxing, they're all beautiful together. In fact, Wrestle Like a Girl, this last year, we did a girls' combat sport camp where they did an exploratory of each of the five combat sports in round robin style. And then we finished it off with self-defense. And one of the ways that we were able to get new girls to come out and wrestle is by offering a multi-sport component, but then we also introduced them on that platform to wrestling. So when you start to think about what we can do to get more athletes in the sport and how can we get those athletes to become more successful, 100%, I think that being a multi-sport athlete, being able to cross-train, being able to understand proprioception, where your body's at in space, it's a very important thing, and other countries are learning how to do that.
You mentioned Wrestle Like a Girl. I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is a program with your lead that is actually changing the way we view the sport, especially in the women's wrestling movement. Why did you found it, and what's the concept behind Wrestle Like a Girl?
I founded Wrestle Like a Girl because I knew that I was going to be transitioning out of active duty service for the military, and I was also going to be retiring from elite athletics. I wanted to stay involved in the sport, but I didn't want to compete anymore. And as I looked across the national landscape of what it is that I wanted to do, nothing existed yet. I really wanted to be a staunch advocate for the girls and women that were in the sport. I wanted to create more opportunities. I wanted to push the barrier and advance the sport specifically for girls and women, knowing that it could be an equalizer for our men's programs. So that's what I did. I founded the organization. And now here we are a year and almost 2 years later, and we're working on high school state sanctioning. When we first started, there was 6 states that had girls high school wrestling as an official sport. Now there's 12. And of course, we didn't do all of that. What we were able to do was sort of rally the cry and get people collaborating and talking and having conversations. So when we would go out and have meetings with athletic officials for the high school, for the high school state athletic associations, we would go and have those intro conversations. Then we would have people come in and follow us with those supplementary and follow-up conversations. So high school sanctioning, August 1st, we're submitting the NCAA emerging sport status bid, working to get women's wrestling as an official NCAA emerging sport. And then beyond that, we do camps around the country, and we call them empowerment camps because we want to use that as an opportunity to expose girls that might not ever choose the sport of wrestling to wrestling, to see if they might like it. And if so, then we connect them to local clubs or opportunities in the community so that they can continue wrestling.
Sally, you sort of touched on my next question here, which was going to be, why is there so much momentum happening right now in 2018 for girls wrestling and women's wrestling? But maybe the follow up to that is, could you see this coming?
There are multiple factors right now that are encouraging and increasing the support and the momentum for women's wrestling. One, it's in the Olympics. Helen Morales in the United States, Helen Morales winning Olympic gold medal was really significant. Two, having Ronda Rousey and Sarah McMahon in the UFC and highlighting how powerful it is to be able to be a strong, confident woman, that's been helpful. And then having it within our school systems where girls and women are able to see other girls and women with that notion, if they can see it, they can be it. So those are 3 of the factors, in addition to all of the national wrestling entities such as USA Wrestling, Wrestle Like a Girl, the National Wrestling Coaches Association, US Wrestling Foundation, you name it. They're all championing the cause because they all know that as a sport, when we get that inclusion and we open up wrestling to the other half of the population, it's only going to serve our sport good. And as for if I saw this coming, Absolutely. There was a reason why I founded Wrestle Like a Girl, but I started wrestling at the Olympic Training Center in 2002. And in my mind, from 2002 to 2016, there was really limited momentum. And I wanted to get out there and use my skill set and the grit, tenacity, and love of sport that I have and really help advocate and make it happen faster.
You're one of the few people that I've seen that is connected beyond the sport. You're doing things with Michelle Obama. You are on the Megyn Kelly Today Show. That's just a few of the things. It just goes on and on and on about the places you've been and the connections you've made. How did you build those relationships?
I built the relationship because I know that unless you're standing in front of someone telling them why you matter, why your organization matters, they're never going to care. And so I had to bring the human connection. I was going to conferences and summits, and I wasn't sitting in the back taking notes. I was going to the microphone and asking questions. Even if I already knew the answer, I had to be able to say, my name is Sally Roberts. I'm with Wrestle Like a Girl, and I have a question for you that's going to benefit girls and women in the United States. And I made sure that even in the very beginning when I had nervousness and anxiety, my job, just like it was wrestling at the World Championships in Madison Square Garden, was to put one foot in front of the other and not care about any of that. And what I found was that when I started going into these spaces and going into these places talking about wrestling, and I'd never made it about necessarily men's wrestling or women's wrestling, I would go out there and talk about wrestling and the athletes. I was able to get people that have said, I didn't even know that women wrestled. I didn't know that women benefited from this. I didn't know anything about it. And by just having those conversations and dialogues, it opened up people's eyes. And through that, I was able to build a strong network of supporters that said, well, whatever we can do, how can we help? We believe in the mission. We believe in the value. And we actually really like the sport of wrestling. So that's been helpful. And essentially, I've opened up the door and every opportunity that I could to bring someone else along or to go to a summit or speak at a conference. And I would say, yes, but I need a plus one. Can you support that? Then that was when I could show other athletes, bring other athletes with me and show them that there was a platform, their voice mattered, and their careers do not end once you retire. It's up to them to determine when it ends.
Do you want to see wrestling go to universal freestyle?
You know, I would like it. Yeah, I would like it. But at the end of the day, it's not about, for me, which style they wrestle, just if they get the opportunity. And I recognize that I would love freestyle. I think that would be great. But I also recognize that depending on where you live, they don't even know freestyle. They only know folk style. And if there's never an opportunity for a girl to wrestle, it's going to be folk style. So at the end of the day, I just want them to be able to wrestle. And if the opportunity for them to do freestyle is presented, I hope that they would choose that.
All right. As we close out here, you have an event in September. I want you to give that a plug and tell us how to get involved in that event in Colorado, I believe, in the middle of September.
Yes. September 14th and 15th. What we are really good at here with Wrestle Like a Girl is doing collaborations. September 14th, we are partnering with the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. They have a Center for Critical Sports Studies. And I have a lot of my friends from the international and national sport, human rights, and business space that are going to be flying in, talking about a lot of different concepts, but basically bridging that sport and human rights conversation. And the reason that that's important is because like Raha Muharrik is going to fly out, who's the first Saudi woman to summit Mount Everest. Well, it seems like a really incredible feat, but we also have girls that are now wrestling and we have in our first Olympic gold medalist. So there's feats that women are having and we have to be able to praise them, but we also need to know that there's a lot of room for growth. And so that's part of the reason why we're having our summit. And then the following night, all of those key stakeholders, thought leaders, and influencers are going to be attending our gala, and it's going to be all about women's wrestling, and the theme is wrestling with life and winning. And if anyone would love to attend, you're more than welcome to. We have tables that are going on that are for sale. If you can't attend and you want to purchase a table just to support, we can get some athletes to attend and sit at your table. That would be great. If you want to just make a donation, that would be phenomenal, because this is the main event every year that we raise our funds so that we can push and promote wrestling, collegiate wrestling, high school wrestling, and anything and everything in between so that everyone has the opportunity to participate in the sport that we all love.
Visit wrestlelikeagirl.org. It's a wonderful website. You can get all the information there. We've been talking with Sally Roberts. Really enjoyed this conversation, and we are all behind you promoting women's wrestling and excited to see you get to more than halfway. Let's get it to 100, where full acceptance for the sport of wrestling for all genders.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. That was Sally Roberts. For Andy Hamilton, I'm Kyle Klingman. You've been listening to On the Mat.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.